The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So usually the full moon around this time, around May, that the Buddhist cultures of Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma, Cambodia, India, celebrate, have the major religious Buddhist holiday of the year. It's named after the ancient Buddhist, or maybe, I don't know, maybe Indian name for the month, Vesakh, and corresponds approximately to May. It's a lunar calendar. And and it's a remarkable holiday in that in all and rolls up in one day, they're celebrating the Buddha's birthday, his enlightenment, and his death. And symbolically, I think it's quite powerful to roll all those together, because birth and death represent kind of the big existential issues of human life. You know, so they're kind of like the umbrella terms for many of the challenges and joys of human life that we go through. And then sitting between birth and death in this holiday is the Buddha's enlightenment, smack in the middle. And so what is it that enlightenment has to offer in this existential life of the joys and suffering of life, the challenges we have? I don't think it's easy to live a human life. Many years ago, I heard about a conference of Buddhist teachers in America. And somehow a lot of the people talked about enlightenment, and different Buddhist traditions have different ideas of what that is. And then a Korean Buddhist teacher got up to speak. And apparently he talked in a very moving way that kind of shifted the mood for the conference. He said, you know, for the communities of people that I minister and care for here in the United States, the idea of enlightenment is not that relevant. I'm working with people who are struggling with gang memberships and violence and domestic abuse and, you know, unemployment and all these kind of existential challenges. And that's where I'm interested in. That's where I bring my Buddhism, my practice, to meet those people. Ideally, the existential issues, the deep challenges that we have in our lives are something that enlightenment is relevant for, and Buddhist teachings is important for. But I think it's easy sometimes in the idealism of Buddhism to forget or to stay grounded in the immediacy of our lived life and what's really going on with people, and maybe sometimes kind of end up in the clouds with ideas, lofty ideas. So we celebrate, this is a day to celebrate the Buddha, so to maybe here at IMC for this day to commemorate the founder of Buddhism, to talk about a little bit, to remember him, and to talk about the value and the importance of Buddha for our lives. The certainly I think many people could easily recognize how important this person is in their lives. I mean, all of you here, we wouldn't be together as a group here unless it wasn't for this person 2,500 years ago. Probably we'd be organizing our Sunday morning around something different if the Buddha didn't exist. And maybe some of it would be somewhat similar. Maybe it's other religious traditions would have meditation or something similar like that. But, you know, to actually all of us, you know, we'd all find different things. But now, for some reason, this day, in this place, we've all come here, and it represents, or it is, in some ways, the continuity, the fulfillment, the fruition of this person's life in the Bronze Ages, quite a long time ago, and some momentum that's set in motion by this person. And I think for anyone to set in motion a momentum that could reach us to this modern world, and that spreads around the globe and kind of not only impacted many people, but really shaped many cultures in important ways, that that's a remarkable achievement, a remarkable impact that someone has had. And so it's kind of, certainly interesting to commemorate and recognize that kind of impact of any human being. So who was the Buddha? And we know actually very little about who the Buddha was. But logically, we can say that there's two Buddhas. We assume that there was an actual human Buddha who walked on the earth, who peed and pooped and probably farted and occasionally, and who had his own challenges. That the records talk about him having a bad back and becoming injured, being sick, having food poisoning, and all kinds of challenges he had that he went through his life. And it's because of his challenges, it's said, that because of the suffering that he experienced, that motivated him to go out for a quest. And he wasn't alone in going for a spiritual quest, for some kind of liberation. My impression is, reading the ancient texts, that there was some of the best and the brightest people of the times, that's what they did. To understand something deeply, to understand the nature of this life and our experience, that they weren't designing iPhones and apps and, and some of the best and brightest around here have been doing that for some time. There wasn't so much like that to do, but so the best and brightest, my impression, was they engaged in very deep inquiry into the nature of the mind, the nature of the universe, trying to understand this and as a way of dealing with their existential situation. And the Buddha was one of those people. He went forth into a life to explore this, and he absorbed a lot of that milieu, the teachings of that milieu, and then came to his own synthesis of that, his own resolution of these issues into what became Buddhism. And so he was definitely a human being, a remarkable human being, but we know very little about him. The other Buddha is the Buddha of the traditions, all the different traditions, where he becomes more of a mythic person, represents ideals that people have, and that people present in stories and in art. And we can see it right here at IMC, this side of the Buddha. We have no idea what he looked like, no idea whatsoever. And these three statues we have up here are fairly idealized statues. It's kind of like, I think, a certain kind of idea of human perfection and uprightness, and doesn't look like a person with this one here with a bad back. And this one here, he looks like he had the spa. someone should be feeding him grapes. It's a depiction of the Buddha dying. And he died when he was 80, 81 years old. And this one doesn't have any wrinkles. It doesn't look like an 80-year-old person. The tendency is to, when idealized pictures of the Buddha, never show him, or rarely show him as an old person, but they kind of show him in the prime of life, radiant, it's very idealized, and to die this way, like he looks pretty relaxed, at ease, and it's a kind of, it's a powerful image in some ways, but it's also idealized. And even more idealized is the statue here of the Buddha. This is a picture of the baby Buddha just born. This is like minutes from after being born, and at this point he's standing. So that's pretty, a bit of a prodigy kind of thing. He actually takes seven steps, not just standing. He can walk steps, but he doesn't just take seven steps. He speaks, and he points his finger. Remember my son when he was really teeny on the changing diaper table. And I was looking at him, doing things with his fingers and hands. And I thought, is this person ever going to be able to use his fingers? There's no dexterity, no coordination, no control whatsoever. Is this ever going to happen? Anyway, so this person, lifts up his, points his finger, one finger to the sky, and the other finger, you can see down here, points to the earth. And he says something like, this, at least in one traditional version, heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one. Now, this is a person who's going to end up teaching no self, not self. You know, I alone am the world-honored one. And I often tell that story for the kids' programs here at IMC, and exactly that way, about him saying that. And the kids take it just to be a myth. They don't think there's a baby who can walk and speak, so it's kind of a safe thing to say. And then I say to him, it's kind of one of those unusual statements that it's really what it's saying, that each of us is special. And I point to each of them and say, you're wonderful, you're wonderful, you're wonderful. And each of us should be able to say that for ourselves. So I don't know if that inculcates, even more conceit in an individualistic culture, but I think that, Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis, early Buddhism, on valuing the individual and the possibility and potential of the individual and the dignity of the individual. And this kind of statue of the Buddha here sitting so strong and upright is an example of a certain kind of human dignity that we can all attain. So there's all these stories and myths. There's a Buddha of the traditions. And to say that the Buddha of myths, which I tend to come out my mouth fairly easily, could be seen as disrespectful, because these are really important stories and models and imagery that cultures get organized around. And to understand different cultures, Buddhist cultures, and to respect them is to understand those stories. Some people say, some scholars of religion say, that religions are more about stories than they are about belief systems, and that there might be beliefs that are important, but how those beliefs are enacted in life, the examples of how people live them, is what sometimes touches the heart. It's the stories that somehow kind of embody and bring life to the tradition. And so Buddhists tell a lot of stories, and they tell stories about the Buddha's life. And those stories are all very important, teachings, indicators, models for how people live. So, for example, I'm quite fond of this story of this one here. You don't see it here because the statue of the reclining Buddha is in front. But the main image we have at IMC, the Buddha, he's sitting in meditation, upright, and his right hand is draped very lightly, gently over his right knee. And it's either reaching down or just reach down to touch the earth. It's called the earth-touching mudra, earth-touching gesture. And the way the story goes, it was the night of the Buddha's awakening, and he had a lot of challenges to that night that he faced and overcame. But then there was a last challenge. And the last challenge was his doubt whether he was worthy of becoming enlightened. And I've talked to a lot of people who practice, and this issue of sometimes of being, I'm not really worthy, I'm not really capable of becoming free, of developing myself in significant spiritual ways. And so sometimes people are undermining themselves with doubt about themselves, or being self-effacing in some way that's undermining. And so the Buddha also seems to have had that. And then he reaches his hand forward, touches the earth, in order to call upon the earth, or the goddess of the earth, as the witness for his right, or his capacity, or his appropriateness to become enlightened, become free. And when they touches the earth goddess, creates a little earthquake that chases away the last of the hindrances for the Buddha, and is an attestment that it's appropriate for him to become awakened. And with that, he lets go deeply. He really lets go of the attachment to self, lets go of attachment, all of his attachments. But this idea of connecting to the earth, for me, is a very powerful image, a very powerful story that inspires me, because I feel that if we remove ourselves from the natural world and live kind of in a certain kind of anthropocentric kind of focus, we kind of shut off who we are, part of who we are, and that to become whole, to really recognize who we are, is to recognize also ourselves as nature and ourselves as part of nature, and that somehow the movement towards real freedom and liberation has to somehow recognize that connection, has to open to that possibility. Whether you agree with me or not, I just wanted to offer that as an example of one person who takes one of the ancient stories and finds it very inspiring and meaningful. And whether it's true or not, I don't think it was true. I think it's kind of the story people told, and it's true as a story. It's true as something that speaks to the heart and speaks to something that's very important. And so we have these kinds of two sides of the Buddha. The Buddha who was a person and the Buddha of the traditions, and both of them have value. For me, I find a lot of value with the idea that the Buddha was a human being and not any different than any of us. And so whatever he was able to attain should be available for us. Whatever he was able to realize is relevant for us as well. And that, you know, he wasn't so different. When he sat down to close his eyes and to focus on his breathing, he had probably in the course of his lifetime almost identical experiences of the body breathing, the chest expanding and contracting, the diaphragm moving, as you experience when you sit down to meditate. You know, it's kind of I find it kind of inspiring. Wow, you know, the Buddha felt that, and, you know, wow, didn't I get to feel that too? Yeah, I feel a certain kinship that, you know, some of the basic human experiences are so similar, and when you sit down and feel and sense them in some way. But what's interesting about who the Buddha was is that in some ways he didn't want to be seen as an ordinary human being. Though he didn't seem to he didn't seem to himself create myths about himself or stories about himself. But when people asked him who he was or when he talked about himself, he didn't want to be defined or limited by a definition of who he was, but to leave it quite open. And so he had this very unusual name for himself. This is the way, when he talked about himself, he didn't call himself the Buddha. He didn't call himself Gotama, which was his family name. And he didn't call himself Siddhartha, because no one called him Siddhartha until about 500 years after he lived. That seems to be part of the storytelling tradition, to give him that name. And he called himself Tathagata. And kind of the best theory, interpretation of what this word means, it means the one, the person, the one who is thus. What does that mean? the one who is such. And so it's kind of like, you know, I am what you see, or I'm not going to define. There's no need to me to define who I am. No need to say this is who I am. I can just stand here, upright, tall, free, alive, without apologizing for myself or defending myself or asserting myself, and just I'm such, I'm like this. And so that's not much. That, you know, that's how he wanted to be known, which is not quite in human terms. Also, when before he died, he explicitly refused to appoint anyone to be his successor. And so that also left no one else after him as the exemplar of what the whole tradition is all about, as a leader for it, as all of Buddhism in a sense. And so that left him as the founder, as the person for whom was still remained kind of the exemplar, the leadership. And so that also maybe contributed to why it was so important for the traditions down through the centuries to keep focusing on him and have stories of him and statues of him in order to, be inspired, for their inspiration and for their teaching. And so the Buddha is certainly someone to feel grateful for because of, you know, what he's contributed to us. And for some people, the sense of gratitude towards the Buddha is quite profound, and it really can be transformative. For some people, the Buddha is someone very inspiring. The teachings are inspiring, his example is inspiring, his being, the whole thing is inspiring. Whether it's the human person or the traditional stories of it, people are quite inspired. The Buddha is an exemplar, and he wanted to be an exemplar. He said if sometimes that he lived in such a way for compassion for future generations. And one example where he did this, he said, I go and meditate in the woods by myself sometimes. I go meditate in the woods under trees out of compassion for future generations as an exemplar. I think he had the idea of going to meditate outdoors is really good. There's something about the nature and connecting maybe, or certainly meditating, that he really wanted to exemplify. This is important. This is valuable. So the Buddha was an exemplar. But there's another thing that the Buddha functions for many people, and certainly for me. And this is represented by something that Zen Master Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, said. In the 1960s, when he was teaching there, there were plenty of Westerners coming to learn Buddhism, encounter Buddhism through Zen and through him. And there's a lot of bowing in the Zen Center. And so it's not uncommon for Westerners who don't grow up with bowing to have some trouble with that and challenged about this bowing stuff. And so they'd ask him, what about the bowing? What are you bowing? So someone asked, what are you bowing to when you bow to the Buddha? And he said, I'm bowing to myself. So there's a way in which the Buddha becomes a mirror for ourselves. It's a way of looking at these things, not to see this person far in the past, but to see ourselves. And the more idealized these images are, the more they function as a kind of a mirror within which to see oneself, to see a potential, a possibility in oneself. And one of the places where I've seen it most powerfully is sitting in meditation. That there's something that happens in strong meditation when we're really embodied and centered on ourselves, that that the ordinary concepts we have of ourselves, the ordinary stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, some of them which are undermining us or quite painful and difficult, temporarily fall away. There's something about sitting in strong meditation, and there's a meditative energy of uprightness and clarity and strength that arises that creates a very different sense of being alive, of being in a body, that kind of breaks out of the shackles of the conditionings that we have. And in that state where we're kind of broken free from those shackles or those limitations, when we can be just thus here in an upright, dignified way, that the feeling that it has, the radiance, the goodness, the warmth, the way that feels, sometimes is best exemplified in art, symbolically almost. In one meditation center where I've sat at, they had a very large tanka, a painting of a Buddha on the wall that had a series of auras around it painted, halos and stuff, and the body was different colors, and it was very, very idealized to the point of, almost looking like a cartoon. But it's beautiful, beautiful. And I looked at that for a long time, and it kind of didn't speak to me until one day I said, wait a minute. There's a way in which that's depicting how I feel when I meditate. I don't have an aura. It isn't that, but there's a feeling of radiance and warmth, and the rich colors that of that painting. It kind of spoke to the richness and the energy and the lightness and the light and the clarity and the goodness that is felt experientially here. Oh, that's what's. And so then it became a mirror for something inside. And so to see these the Buddha as a mirror for oneself. Certainly a mirror for what's possible, our potential, but maybe also a mirror for what we begin to experience for ourselves through meditation or through other things. I think one of the first experiences I had in my life that really spoke to me, really got my attention in a serious way, maybe even set a direction for my life, that then I kind of associated with that statue or the Buddha and how that was. So it was, again, the Buddha functioned as a mirror for that experience that I had. It was not a Buddhist experience. It happened in a Christian chapel, Catholic chapel, but I'm not Christian, so I didn't really, you know, if I had been, it would have been, God had descended or something. It was a powerful experience. But I walked into this little chapel, and if you've ever been to a cathedral, I guess, or monastery in France called Mont Saint-Michel, I was 18, and I had spent the night before at a Pax Christi Christian hostel, because that was a cheap place to stay, and I had broken bread in the morning with the priest, because that's how they serve for breakfast. And so it was kind of a touching place to be, and so I walked up in early morning up into the monastery for a tour of the cathedral, the monastery. And it's a huge, it's like Disneyland kind of huge place. It was spires up in the sky. But it was built all around a small stone chapel on top of the hill from 1,000 more years ago or so. And as we walked into the heart of that monastery, the profound peace descended on me. And I felt so kind of embodied in my body, a feeling of peace that I never had before. In my hippie days, the language I had was, this was a power center. that sense of, I didn't know of this potential of this kind of strong embodied sense of peace until that time in my life. And so that's, I think that experience, that potential knowing that, was one of the things that was kind of gave a gravitational force for me towards what I found originally, finally in Buddhism. And then in Buddhism, I was able to tap into that sense of peace again in a meaningful way. So the Buddha as an exemplar. So for me, I'm inspired by the Buddhas of the tradition, and I'm inspired by the Buddha as a person, and I kind of see them as two different domains or places. I want to tell you a story about this resonance or this way of seeing oneself in the Buddha or seeing the Buddha in oneself or back and forth. When I was in practicing for a year in Japan, Zen monasteries in Japan, I went to a small Zen temple where they had a rock garden, and the rock garden wasn't very big. It was you went out of this kind of tatami room, sliding glass doors, onto a little wooden engawa, a little deck, and there was a somewhat narrow, longish rock garden that was probably maybe 8 feet wide and maybe 20 feet long. So it wasn't very big for rock gardens. And there was situated there were maybe two or three large boulders, and then it was raked gravel, and it had been created something like in the 1400s or 1300s, so hundreds of years ago. And every day they probably raked it, and it was raked kind of in circles around those big boulders. And I got it there, and I was just kind of immediately silenced, looking at these rocks, this garden. So I sat down to just be with it and look at it. I was amazed that some artists 500-600 years ago had managed to depict in art my breathing in meditation. That's what I saw in the rocks. I thought, that's kind of strange. Wow, I just kind of feel this resonance and immediately connected to my meditation. I just sat there feeling that breathing. And then I went and looked on the plaque on the wall for the name of the garden, and the name was Breathing In, Breathing Out. And so this resonance that we can feel with things that represent something or speak to something, that same year that I was in Japan, I saw a lot of Buddhas. And I would go to museums sometimes, and Japanese museums would have, you know, Buddha statues as part of the museum exhibits. And I developed a habit or a custom of, when I looked at Buddha statues, to always look at the chest, because I wanted to see if I could feel the resonance. You know, that somehow that the statue had captured something of a deep inner quality, or of the artist, or of the tradition, or something that I could then feel myself, this resonance. And sometimes there were highly valued and appreciated statues in the art of that country that didn't have the resonance for me. And then every once in a while I'd come across statue, wow, it would be there. It's like, and then I would stand there for a long time just watching. So what is it that speaks to your heart? What is it in the tradition, in Buddhism, in the teachings? Is there anything that really doesn't just keep you in the idea of beliefs, ideas, of what Buddhism is, teachings, but something that drops you into something that's deeper in yourself, in your direct experience, and resonates with something that, or have you had any experience in your life of something that might resonate with what Buddhism is pointing towards? Something in your heart, something in your chest, something in your physical embodied beings, something in your mind. Is there anything at all that kind of speaks to it, that what this whole enterprise is about makes it very personal? Not an impersonal Buddhism out there, but very something personal in here. And we find in this ancient tradition, the early teachings, the Buddha put tremendous emphasis that his teachings were about personal direct experience, more so than beliefs. He seems to have had a very strong reluctance to emphasize beliefs. And when he used the word truths, he seldom used them as kind of propositional truths, like statements of belief, but rather truths of what we can experience directly for ourselves. And we see this around a particular teaching called the Four Resolves. And I want to share the end this talk with the Four Resolves. And I would like to do it in a way that hopefully is a little bit more experiential. So we'll see if we can pull this off. So the Four Resolves. So first the word resolve. The ancient word in Pali is adhitana, which can be translated into English as a higher stand. It's what we take a stand on. Which, you know, we say that in English, you know, to take a stand on something, and I'm going to... So to really ground ourselves on something, to be firm with something, to really make something kind of the basis upon which we maybe live our life. To take a stand is a strong statement. I take a stand on this now. But the English word resolve, I love as a translation, rather than determination, because it comes from the Latin word for solution, like a liquid solution. And like dissolve means going back into solution. Resolve means kind of to put it back into solution, or to untie, sometimes they say it means. To solve or to resolve, in my ears, has this connotation not of being firm or hard, but actually becoming soft and open and relaxing, untying. And these two meanings, I think, work well together. That whatever this adhitana means, it's some wonderful combination of the firmness of taking a stand and the softness and the opening up of resolve, of dissolving somehow, and that combination. So he offered four things that take a stand on, or four things to help us open into the solution, as a solution. And these four things are truth, wisdom, generosity, and peace. These are not beliefs. You're not supposed to believe in these things. They're not statements of belief, but rather this is a kind of orientation, a sense of purpose, a sense of value that we can organize our life around. The embodied experience of truth. What is that? What does that mean? What's true right now? The embodied experience of wisdom. Why would we connect wisdom with being embodied? Isn't wisdom about ideas? The embodied experience of generosity. What happens when generosity is embodied, comes out of the body? And then the embodied experience of peace. So I'd like to guide you through a little kind of guided meditation, guided exercise around these four. And so you might want to sit in a meditative way, and upright and alert. And if you were going to sit here as if you are a Buddha, with no doubts about your worthiness, your right to be awakened, to be free, with no doubts, and know for a few moments, without any concern with those ideas that diminish you or undermine you, but you sit here breathing, upright, alert. Having the same, maybe, experience as the Buddha had. Tuning into the body, tuning into breathing. In our direct embodied experience, maybe there's not a big distance between you and the Buddha. And I'm going to ask four questions, because questions can be opening. One question for each of the four resolves. And rather than answering the questions only from your ideas and mind, can there also be a movement, an expression, a feeling in your body? In response to the questions, can the answers be found in your body, in your direct experience? What is true now? In your direct experience now, here, what is true? What is preventing ease with what is true now. What gets in the way of being conflict-free with your direct, immediate experience now? What is preventing ease with what is true now? And then for generosity, what can I offer that opens everyone to truth and ease now? What can I offer that opens everyone to truth and ease now? And finally, what peace is here now, through which to view what is true, wise, and generous? What peace is available now that can provide the vantage point for seeing what's true, what brings ease, and what is generous? Is there any peace anywhere in your system, maybe in the corners of it, the basement or the attic? Is there any peace that doesn't just exist for its own sake, but can be a teacher for you, that can be your Buddha, to help you with seeing the truth, how to be at ease, and how to be generous? May the Buddha of Buddhism point you to the Buddha that's in you.